From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy.
And that's the sound of Occupy Wall Street Thursday night outside New York City Hall. The protesters are no longer allowed to pitch tents in Zuccotti Park near Wall Street, leaving MSNBC's Ed Schultz to answer the obvious existential question with the most rigorous of journalistic tools.
Tonight's question, will the raid on Zuccotti Park strengthen the 99% movement? Text A for yes, text B for no to 622-639.
So, is it A or B? Deprived of its iconic locale, is it doomed? MIT civic media professor Sasha Costanza-Chock says that within what's been portrayed as a spontaneous outcry, there's a lot of hidden media savvy.
Occupy, of course, has access to everything from face-to-face and print to real-time live streaming. You have hand-painted signs, and then you have social media. You have techie activists who are actually building entirely new tools. There's a lot of media makers who have lots of skills from previous protest experience. And then when Occupy came around, they immediately got involved in amplifying the voice of the movement. The people who set up the Global Revolution live stream, which is a live streaming channel from New York, although there are now live streams from many of the different camps, is a group called Glassbead Collective and folks from the Twin Cities Indie Media. And I first encountered them in 2008 during the Republican National Convention.
How important do you think the loss of the iconic location will be? Do you see the possibility that it could just fade away?
I don't think it's likely. I think that it's too early to say whether or not the encampments will be dismantled around the country by coordinated police action. And in some ways, it could turn out to be a good thing for the movement if it's forced to prove its strength by working in many more community spaces. It's kind of like this big laboratory for democracy. So people go there and they learn from each other about different strategies for mobilizing, and then they take that and they circulate those ideas to their friends and social networks, and more recently via traditional mass media. And they've managed to change the national conversation. There's enough people now who've had their lives transformed by participating in the process. I think that we'll be seeing the impact of Occupy for a long time to come.
Sasha, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sasha Costanza-Chock teaches civic media at MIT.
The Occupy movement loudly decries the power of corporate money in politics, a power amplified by the Supreme Court's interpretation of the 14th Amendment, conferring the free speech rights of people on corporations. Thus, in last year's Citizens United ruling, the court on free speech grounds granted corporations nearly unlimited freedom to spend on election advertising. This week, Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern decided to try something drastic and most likely futile to stop the deluge. He called for a constitutional amendment declaring that corporations are not people. Congressman, welcome to On the Media.
Happy to be with you.
Now, you're the House Minority Whip, but you can't whip the majority. The odds are, and you know it, that this will fail to get out of committee, much less ratification by the states. So what are you up to?
At a very minimum, I'm up to trying to force a debate in this country on the fact that corporations are gaining more power than average people. People have the right to free speech. People who work in corporations have the right to free speech. But corporations are not people. They are artificial entities which we, the people, create, and as such, we govern them, not the other way around. Corporations can now donate to campaigns in an unlimited way. That's not good for our democracy.
This is a bill that might have been penned by Occupy Wall Street. Citizens United could be seen as the ultimate case in point for those who believe that our inalienable rights as individuals have been usurped by the man. Was this legislation inspired by those protests or just kind of a product of the same zeitgeist?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I have to be honest with you. I think the Occupy Wall Street movement has been refreshing. And I think part of their frustration is my frustration, that corporations have too much power in politics. And it's not just the Citizens United case. Recently, a federal judge blocked the Food and Drug Administration from requiring tobacco companies to place graphic warning labels on cigarette packages, arguing that the cigarette makers had the right to free speech. This is crazy. Look, I want businesses to be successful. I want corporations to be successful. But I don't want corporations to be equated with people.
Is this an act of principle or just a political tactic?
No, it's an act of principle. I'm not into political tactics. I will admit to you that the chances
I'm sorry. I have to, I'm sorry. You are the House Minority Whip. I refuse to accept your assertion that you are not into political tactics.
I guess we need to define whether political tactics have principles or not. I mean, this is not out there just to help Democratic candidates. I want Republicans to co-sponsor this too. And I think there are some Republicans out there who also agree that corporations have too much power in our government.
In fact, some of them are in the Tea Party.
And you know, and my hope is that those Tea Party conservatives who claim that they value the Constitution will join with me in this effort. This would apply not just to corporations, but to unions as well. The problem is that the leadership down here is very much influenced by these big corporate entities. And now with the Citizens United case, opening the floodgates so that corporations have even more of a voice in our political system, you're going to see Washington respond less and less to the concerns of average Americans. This, I hope, will begin a debate here in Congress. The debate that the Occupy Wall Street movement people are talking about, people are talking about the fact that corporations have undue influence in this country. Washington is not.
One final thing. Let's just divorce ourselves from reality for a moment and imagine that this bill is passed by 2/3 of the House and then ratified by 38 states. Now, the last amendment to do that, the 27th Amendment, required 202 years to get the 38th state. ExxonMobil could elect a lot of presidents in 202 years, and you would probably be in the twilight of your career. Is this going to go the way of the couple hundred other proposed amendments, or is something more going to take place?
I'd like there to be an up or down vote. I'd like the American people to know where members of Congress stand on this issue, Republicans and Democrats. But if it went to the states, I think this is popular. You know, with Democrats, I think it's popular with Republicans and independents. People get it. The American people are way ahead of the Congress. There's only two ways to change the Citizens United ruling. One is to get a new Supreme Court that will interpret the Constitution differently, or the other is through a constitutional amendment. Either way is fine with me, but I'm not going to bet on the fact that the Supreme Court is going to change anytime soon, so I think we ought to go this route.
All right. Congressman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Congressman Jim McGovern is a Democrat from Massachusetts.
The NBA, blessed with record ratings during last season's playoffs and stars like LeBron James and Dirk Nowitzki, is on the verge of not having a season this year. Regular games have already been missed because players and franchise owners are fighting for their respective shares of the pie. It's a story as old as time, but not a particularly easy one to cover, especially for sports writers. After all, says NPR sports reporter Mike Pesca, most sports reporters are also fans.
I think the number one factor underlining all the sports reporting around this is that we really, really want to have an NBA season. It's a lot different from when UPS went out on strike, or it's a lot different when Hormel did, or Overnight, or Verizon, where usually the labor reporters, sure, they're human beings, they want workers to get a fair deal, but they're sort of reporting things with less of a vested interest.
So like when David Stern, the commissioner of the league who represents the owners, comes out and says, "This is the best deal I can give to you. You should take it." The reporters say, "Oh my God, this is the best deal?"
Let's take an example. When he says, "We're now in our nuclear winter," a good quote. But if a similar quote, an Armageddon-like quote, were given by the president of UPS when they were negotiating with the Teamsters, it would have been taken with more of a grain of salt than that quote was taken by the NBA writers, or at least the people who decide how much play to give the NBA story. I'll give you another example. There was a story a few weeks ago about the discontent among owners, and it portrayed David Stern as trying to hold together a coalition of owners, and this latest offer might eventually evaporate. All that could be true, but in the reporting, I didn't see it sufficiently noted. It's all in the NBA owners' interest to tell the public and the players, sort of the good cop, bad cop, "Watch out, my partner there's crazy. Who knows what he's going to do? You better take the offer while we can."
Outline the narrative that you hear so often that makes you think, boy, these sports reporters are really out of their depth.
This is a case of millionaires versus billionaires. And when will they come to their senses? When do they realize that it is a privilege to play the game and settle their differences? Well, like how? Why? I mean, we're talking about rational economic actors. It doesn't matter if you're talking about $20,000 a year or $2 million a year. There is still a rational economic calculus for each set of figures. And we hear it in moral terms. We don't hear it in rational economic calculus terms. It doesn't surprise me. The conversation about sports is quite often a stand-in for the conversation about morality. It often becomes a morality tale. This guy hit in the clutch because he has moral fiber and moral toughness. Or this guy, you know, blew the coverage on the pass because he's obviously has character defects.
And this story is particularly difficult, isn't it? It's so hard to track the money to determine which side's telling the truth. How many sports reporters have expertise in forensic accounting?
If you read the good sports reporters, they're good reporters. If you read people like Chris Mannix and Ian Thompson in Sports Illustrated, Henry Abbott writing for the True Hoop part of ESPN, Ken Berger on CBS, Larry Kuhn, who is a web-only expert on the salary cap, these guys know what they're talking about. My main complaint is the shorthand that is sometimes used in the headlines on places like ESPN in quick hit segments on sports radio, where it's usually presented that the players have screwed themselves out of money because the act of canceling games is seen as a failure, is seen as stupidity, is seen as selfishness.
So, you know, if it's millionaires versus billionaires, and the sports writers have a vested interest, they're expressing the primal scream they think they're hearing from the fans, but they're not really necessarily examining the case.
90% of your audience thinks it is millionaires versus billionaires, and I can't believe they can't settle it. And the conversation that's being had on sports talk radio isn't because the audience disagrees. It's because the audience is going, hell yeah, preach on, brother. I'm just saying that there should be a little more examination of the fact that these are negotiating tactics as much as these are moral positions or smart or foolish choices.
Mike, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mike Pesca covers sports for NPR.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Syria saw what may have been the single deadliest day since the uprisings there began in March, with estimates ranging from 50 to more than 80 dead in one 24-hour period. But this week also saw some of the biggest blows to the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Deserters from the Syrian army reportedly attacked government offices, and the region's leaders, too, are turning against Assad. Last Saturday, the Arab League suspended Syria's membership and then gave Syria 3 days to, quote, stop the bloody repression of its people and allow outside observers in. Foreign policy blogger Mark Lynch says that the very idea that fellow Arab leaders are even questioning Assad's legitimacy on the grounds of killing his own people represents a significant shift in the political mentality of the Arab world. In fact, he says, it's unprecedented.
It really is a radical departure for the Arab League. That's an institution that's totally built on state sovereignty, giving them carte blanche to do whatever they want to their own people.
And in fact, even among nations that have voted for this suspension, impunity is still pretty much the status quo, right?
Well, let's put it this way. The Saudis didn't really have a problem with a crackdown in Bahrain, and Bahrain itself continues to carry out widespread repression of its own people, and its legitimacy has not yet been challenged. Really, across the entire region, you still have very high levels of repression, of control. But for the first time, there does seem to be a level over which you lose your right to be a member of the club. That is something new. And that seems to be as blatant as taking your army and shooting lots of your own people in the streets. So it's a pretty high threshold, but it is a threshold. You've just got this unbelievable change in the media. You've got all of these people uploading these videos and sharing information, which just makes it impossible to hide this sort of thing. In Syria, every day you're being bombarded with dozens of videos of people with their heads blown off. It makes it much more real and much more graphic and intimate compared to just reading in the newspaper that a bunch of Kurds were killed in Iraq.
So the rules of the game have now changed on an official Arab League level. What about in the populace?
One of the most interesting things that I've seen over this extremely interesting year is that among most of popular opinion, you've seen the rejection of the old idea that Western intervention was worse than these abuses. It used to be that the Syrian government could have just said, this is a conspiracy against a staunch opponent of Israel, and that would have been enough to shut people up. In these uprisings, it just hasn't been enough. When Bashar al-Assad tried to pull that card, it was roundly rejected. The idea that, you know, this is less than 10 years after the invasion of Iraq, which was incredibly, almost universally rejected across Arab public opinion, that now you would have large majorities of Arabs calling for Western intervention in places like Libya or Syria is breathtaking.
Let's just go back in time a little bit and talk about what else has happened in the region. Just the very existence of Al Jazeera, the rise of social media, the revolution in Tunisia, the rest of the Arab Spring, and now this.
And in that new Middle East, the new media environment is extremely important. The idea that states can no longer hide what they do at home really matters. One of the more interesting things which has happened has to do with Al Jazeera itself. In many ways, the entire Arab Spring is the culmination of the kind of coverage that Al Jazeera broadcast for the last decade. This passionate pan-Arab vision of critiquing the status quo, supporting the efforts of the people for change. All of these things are at the core of the Al Jazeera mission. But over the last 6 months, Al Jazeera has been struggling because they've become so closely identified with Qatari foreign policy that they're seen as less independent as they once were. And in some cases, people feel that they've overplayed their hand. Their intense coverage of the Libya war and now their intense coverage of the Syrian uprising, at a certain point, it starts to feel more like advocacy than like journalism. And I think that Al Jazeera is going to really have to struggle to rebalance itself in the coming years.
Let me ask you, Mark, a chicken and egg question. Is the coverage that you see shaping the new mentality on the street and within these governments, or, you know, vice versa?
I think it's a bit of both. One of the most interesting moments in the Arab revolutions was on January 25th, right at the beginning of the Egyptian revolution. And Al Jazeera was determined at that particular moment to focus attention on the so-called Palestine Papers, which revealed the inner workings of the peace process. And so they were putting out story after story about the Palestine Papers, but the public wanted to see Egypt. They were forced to basically back off the Palestine story and focus on Egypt because of audience response. At the same time, if you look at what happened in Syria, the Syrian regime complains incessantly that this is a crisis that Al Jazeera created, saying that they're egging the protesters on, exaggerating the violence, etc. And I don't think it's right. The Syrian government's use of violence is what has fueled the uprising. But there's no question that Al Jazeera's relentless coverage of the story has very much focused Arab attention upon it. And when you ask the question, how do you get from internal violence in Syria up to this historic decision by the Arab League, I think the Al Jazeera coverage has to play an important part in that story.
Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mark Lynch is a political science and international affairs professor at George Washington University, and he blogs as Abu Aardvark at Foreign Policy.
Americans take freedom of information, or at least the idea of it, for granted. Since 1967, we've enjoyed the right, theoretically, to request and receive government information in something like a timely manner. And in the last decade or so, so-called FOIA, or right-to-know laws, have become one of America's principal exports. Over 100 countries and the European Union now have them on the books. This year alone, 7 countries have passed right-to-know laws, and 18 more have such laws under consideration. But merely passing FOIA laws does not openness make. The Associated Press recently undertook a massive test of freedom of information laws in nearly every country where they're mandated. Lead reporter on the project, Martha Mendoza, says that they began by asking governments a simple question.
What we asked for were how many people have been arrested and how many people have been convicted as terrorists since 9/11. After 9/11, the United States and the United Nations pushed countries around the world to adopt anti-terrorism laws. And we wanted to know who's been swept into that net, who's been identified and convicted as a terrorist. What we found is that there's been 35,000 convicted terrorists around the world since 9/11.
So that was the answer to your question. Is that because all these countries were really great about providing the information?
That piece of information about terrorists being convicted came partly from the Freedom of Information request, but more so from having to go other directions. Only 14 countries answered in full within their legal deadlines, and another 38 countries eventually answered most of the questions, at least providing some numbers. Interestingly enough, newer democracies were in general more responsive than some of the developed ones. Guatemala got back to us in 72 hours. Turkey was very responsive. Mexico was very responsive. Poland gave us everything we asked for very quickly.
So who are the worst scoff laws?
The 30-some-odd countries that completely ignored us. Kenya actually told our reporter they had never received the request, even though he had had it hand-stamped and had a copy to show them. China was very difficult. They told us we needed to file a Freedom of Information request to find out how to file a Freedom of Information request. And they gave us a fax number to send it into, which didn't pick up.
How about America?
Well, in the United States, I had to mail in 6 certified letters and email the FBI because you have to go to every agency that might have a record. And although I got about 40 pieces of mail back, most of those were just asking for deadline extensions or acknowledging receipt. In the end, we got responsively a single sheet of paper with 4 dates and 2 words and a large section blacked out and a spreadsheet with all the names blacked out.
In 2010, you found that U.S. agencies fully released about 55% of the information requested, as opposed to Mexico, which released 85% of the requested information.
Yeah. Now, Mexico has what's considered the gold standard of a freedom of information law by many, because what they have is a website where you register and then you log in and you can even anonymously make a request to any federal agency in Mexico. You don't have to be a citizen. And even Mexican agencies use this law to get information from other agencies because it is so efficient.
Now, you've cited India as a special case because India seems to offer the best and the worst outcomes for its citizens that use the FOIA laws.
There's been tremendous excitement in India in the last 5 years since they adopted their right to know laws. People there filed about 24,000 requests in 2006. Last year, it was about 1 million, and it has really spawned a culture of anti-corruption in India. However, there's been many attacks and 12 murders so far of people who exposed corruption or revealed wrongdoing, and in doing so became victims of the people who they were finger-pointing.
The countries that have taken on these freedom of information laws have been touting them. They're great PR, but their incentives for adopting those laws were more financial than moral, right?
In many cases, yeah. China changed its access to information rules as a condition of joining the World Trade Organization. Pakistan adopted their ordinance in return for $1.4 billion in aid from the International Monetary Fund. The U.S. State Department ties freedom of information laws to foreign aid. When the citizens rise up and say, we want to have accountability in our government, we want to have transparency, those laws really work. In countries where the law is adopted as a financial incentive, those are the countries we found more often are ignoring them.
And so, having finished the study, what do you walk away with? Do you think it really is making a difference? You cite a story in your report about China, and they say, well, we can get all the information we want, but if it doesn't change policy, what's the point?
In China, a woman got all the records to show that the government had no right to take her aging mom's house and demolish it. And government officials looked at all her records and said, yes, we have no right to take your mother out of her house and demolish her house. And then they took her mother out of her house and demolished the house. So, yes, sometimes having access to information is not going to bring about change. In Mexico, villagers woke up one morning with tractors in their backyard and were surprised to find out a dam was going to be built to wipe out not just their village, but many others. They got public records. They stopped the dam. So, yes, sometimes it can make a difference.
Because you never know, you might be able to stop a dam.
Exactly. Most people who use these laws are not journalists. Most people who use these laws are just members of the public trying to make a difference.
Martha, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Martha Mendoza is a reporter for the Associated Press.
As we heard, the adoption of freedom of information laws has been a decidedly mixed blessing in India. Corruption there runs rampant. One study found that more than 55% of Indians have had to pay a bribe. The country instituted a Right to Information Act in 2005, but the stakes are staggeringly high for Indians who've filed RTI requests. Mejul Srivasta has covered this for Bloomberg News. He says that one thing that India's experiment with the Right to Information Act has shown is that, unintended negative consequences aside, the requests do seem to work.
There was a study that Yale researchers did in 2008 about ration cards. In India, the government rations food out to people who are below the poverty line. And they found that if you paid a bribe or you filed an RTI request to find out why your ration card hadn't been approved, it was equally effective. If you didn't, you might wait three times as long or never even get the ration card that you are by law entitled to.
And now people all over India are filing RTIs, the equivalent of a FOIAs, not necessarily to get to the bottom of some political mischief, but just to get the bureaucracy to work. And what's happened?
You see about 500,000 requests a year, and that's only at the federal level. The state government level, the data is not collected, but there's probably just as many or more requests happening. Most of them are, as you said, about day-to-day bureaucratic activities. Why is the road in front of my house not complete? Why don't I have running water in my house and in my neighborhood? And there are people who will be lobbying to get the Supreme Court justices to reveal their assets, but that's a very small percentage. Most of this is day-to-day stuff that people worry about, and now they have a way to hold the government accountable. Because once they file a FOIA request, once they file an RTI request, it has to be honored within 30 days.
But the bad news is some of them are paying a very heavy price.
That's true. Because the law is so powerful, it also has the ability to threaten incredibly corrupt government officials and their partners in crime. Since January 2010, at least 12 people had been killed. Most of them had been shot. Some of them had been beaten to death because they'd filed an RTI request that would allow others to see who was responsible for whatever local corruption they were trying to expose. There's about 40 people we found who'd been beaten, threatened, socially ostracized because they come from smaller communities. They may be in a village in central India, and they've heard about this law and they figured it out. And once they make the request, the very small number of government officials in that general area will collude to make sure that this information is not made public. And bumping the person off or beating up his family or threatening his livelihood is a very good way of telling these people this is not something you want to be doing.
One of the problems, I gather, is that the person who's charged with processing the RTI request may be the person who's corrupt to begin with.
Yeah, it's a fantastic conflict of interest when you ask the district collector in India, who's kind of like the equivalent of being the top executive in a county over here in America, that I want to see why the electricity hasn't worked for 8 days. And he may have diverted that electricity to somebody else for money. Now, he's got this request in front of him. And if he honors it, his job's in danger. If he doesn't honor it, then you could go to courts and force him to reveal that information.
Has anyone been prosecuted for any of the violent crimes against whistleblowers?
This is an incredibly sad statistic, but of those 12 people who've been murdered, not a single person has been successfully prosecuted.
Is there any evidence that the violence is having a chilling effect on others who would be filing RTIs?
It's tough to kind of track them by numbers because the ones that are not made, you really can't analyze. But there is amongst what they call in India the RTI activist community a certain concern that their lives are in danger. So one of the things that they do is that they form these communities amongst each other through email and listservs and social networking where they share the information amongst each other. So it's not just one person who's in a position to expose corruption. If you're beaten up or your family's threatened, there's hundreds of other people around the country who have now the same information you received.
An info cooperative protecting everybody by sharing the information.
Yeah, and the government's taken a page out of that book because they recently announced an initiative to say that if you, for instance, make an RTI request, and before the request has been honored, you've been assaulted or you've been killed or you've been threatened, the government will then, either by taking out a full-page advertisement in a newspaper or on its websites, take your RTI request and the results of that and make them as publicly available as possible. So that removes the motivation to kill somebody because the government will then extra publicize the information that that person had requested.
And when does that take effect?
We don't have a time for that yet. We may have to file an RTI request to find out what happened with that.
Mehul, thank you very much.
And thanks for having me.
Mehul Srivastava is a reporter at large for Bloomberg.
Coming up, some games heal and others moo in mysterious ways. Bad pun. You'll see.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, supporting Small Business Saturday, and committed to supporting small businesses every day. ConstantContact.com/Saturday. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems. And PewTrust.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day. At WallaceFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In September, we had game designer Jane McGonigal on our show to talk about Super Better, a game she designed to help her recovery from a traumatic brain injury. As McGonigal put it,
think of it as a kind of a recovery adventure game. Then we take you on a series of 7 missions to identify your power-ups. So these are things that you can do every day to feel stronger or feel better. We identify the bad guys, which are things that you need to avoid. We help you pick allies, so close friends and family members that you want to go on this adventure with you. And then we help you think about an epic win. So what would be a really positive outcome? Not just getting back to normal, but something at the end of it that would be even better than normal, that would feel like a real accomplishment. And once you've identified all of that, friends and family can help you take some of this helplessness or hopelessness out of what can be a really difficult process.
It just so happened that 6 months ago, OTM producer Alex Goldman was knocked off his bike and run over by a car. Alex was frankly pretty depressed, limping, experiencing lots of pain, and unable or afraid to ride his beloved bike. We asked Alex to give Super Better a try and blog about it on our site. That blog, by the way, has been terrific. Anyway, his epic win was to get back on the bike and do a lap about 3.5 miles around Brooklyn's Prospect Park. So, Alex, how was it?
Well, to be perfectly honest, the process was really hard. One of the things I hate to do more than anything in the world is to ask for help. And the way that Super Better is designed is it's very explicitly set up so that you get allies who are close friends, or in my case, I recruited a bunch of listeners, and you have to constantly ask them to be mindful of your progress, to help you think of ways that you can improve your situation and reach your epic win. So in that respect, it was really difficult.
We also have Jane, who is one of your allies. Jane, welcome back to the show.
And I actually enjoyed being Alex's ally. I felt really awesome. So it might have been hard for you, but it was really fun to be able to have the chance to help somebody, you know, reach their goal.
The flip side of the fact that it was really difficult was that it was also really nice to have people sort of hold me accountable, because the behavior I developed after the accident was just to sit around and play video games and feel sorry for myself. Having people try and push me toward behavior that actually made me feel better was really super helpful. And Jane, you were one of those people.
One thing that we heard in that tape from Jane earlier is that you have to identify your bad guys, the things that hold back your progress.
Stuff like not socializing, staying up super late and not really getting anything done.
Junk food.
Generally things that kept me sedentary and lethargic and unhappy.
Okay, so the quests that you were given involved vanquishing those bad guys. How successful was that?
Well, I set quests for myself, which were things like walking to a subway stop, which was a little further away than the one I usually go to, going out and socializing twice a week, things that pushed me toward both health physically and health mentally. But the real reward of the game is that my allies actually came up with sort of very creative and interesting quests.
The quest that I thought was absolutely the coolest, I'm not sure which of your allies proposed it. You had to go out to buy something for your wife and buy something for your cat, and you had to walk. I thought that was really cool because I think it tapped into a real motivation you would have, which, you know, you love your cat, you love your wife. Like, yeah, you'll be motivated to go and get them something and bring it back. Instead of, say, maybe just having to, you know, do exercise, it's sort of tied into your social motivation and not just the physical side of
it. Yeah, those were actually really smart quests because they had me doing something in which I would get a reward at the end automatically because mm-hmm. my cats and my wife would both be happier when I got them flowers or a cat toy, respectively. And it also sort of promoted me doing something that would be a net benefit for my injury.
Okay, but let's stipulate that Alex also had some serious complaints about how the game was structured. And one thing that bothered you the most, Alex, was the resilience score, which is essentially the point tally that's supposed to mark your progress. You didn't feel like they were measuring anything.
Well, you'd get resilience points for, say, logging into Superbetter or completing a quest or vanquishing a bad guy or using a power-up. So at the end, I had like 167 points. But 167 points out of what? How does that compare to other Superbetter players? So what I thought would be valuable in terms of making the resilience points more worthwhile in the game would be to have like Superbetter leaderboards where there are people who've been playing for X amount of time, they have X amount of points, or some kind of leveling system where if you reach a certain amount of points, you go to another level and then you become more powerful or you have more options. Jane, you mentioned that there was a leveling system in the works, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one of the cool things, Alex, that you're sort of playing in our closed beta right now. We have about 5,000 people getting Superbetter as a way for us to learn more about the game, to make sure that things like the resilience score mean something, you know, that you're actually getting better in quantifiable ways. So when you started playing, the only thing that we knew for sure is that people report feeling stronger at around 150 points. That was the main thing that we had observed. The next version of the resilience score, which will be out when we do a full public launch in March, will have four elements. So it'll be tracking mental resilience, social resilience, emotional resilience, and physical resilience. We'll also be doing a leveling up system that will help us, you know, be able to show people their progress and their mastery.
Okay, I want to raise Alex's other complaint, the lack of punishment in the game. In a regular video game, you don't just progress. You also suffer setbacks, you lose points, you die 1,000 deaths. Alex missed that.
Because at this particular moment, the way the game's set up is everything I record is some kind of victory. There's no way to record a defeat. And in this situation, there's a lot of defeats. It's a very incremental, two steps forward, one step back kind of situation, trying to overcome something as difficult as being run over by a car. That said, I totally understand that when you're building a game out to help people recuperate from an illness, you don't want to build too much negativity into it.
Right. So one of the features that we've been building out is the bad guy feature. So right now you report battles with bad guys, but you can't actually report whether you felt like you lost it or you won the battle. So that's one of the features that we've designed into the next version. So you actually will be able to report when you've lost a battle. And the resilience score, your actual score on a day-to-day basis, if you're not using your skills regularly, your score does go down. So you do have to stay fully engaged.
This was a 6-week project, and Jane, you told us that often people set a time of 6 weeks in order to achieve their epic win. Alex, you did it. You went around the park. Did it feel epic?
You know, I went into this thinking, okay, this is going to be a game in which I get points for doing things like leg exercises. It's going to be very physical-based, and I'm going to get quantifiable rewards based on sort of physical activity that I do that'll improve me. What I didn't expect was the actual focus, which turned out to be much more about emotional and mental health than it was about physical health. I'd say that a lap around the park is much more symbolic than it is sort of a physical recuperative triumph, because it was just the first time I'd gotten back on my bike and ridden it outside, which has been really difficult and terrifying for me. So I'd say that, yeah, it was epic. It was epic, just not in the way that I expected going into it.
I have to say, personally, as Alex's ally, really realizing how big a challenge this is and what an extreme ordeal it is that he's been through, I personally got goosebumps, you know, hearing him talk about being able to go out and get back on that bike. I want to thank Alex for being a part of this process. You know, the beta process for a game is a period of intense learning, and it's really great to be able to iterate on your design with feedback from really smart and engaged players. The next version is like completely sick. It's amazing, by the way. When you are in your power-ups, you're going to be able to see a real-time feed of all the power-ups that other players are adding. Like if you're doing it for depression, you'll see all the power people are adding for depression. There's going to be global map of people achieving their epic wins. It'll be a lot more social, and it's going to be pretty rad, I have to say. And if anybody else wants to play, there is a secret code that you can share with On the Media listeners, which is SochoFriend, SochoFriend. If anybody wants to get in and play now before the public launch, that's a secret code that they can enter on the website.
How secret is that? You just put it out to a million listeners.
Well, you know, it's secret to everyone who doesn't listen to the show.
Alex, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Alex.
If you want to read Alex's blog entries about playing Super Better, just follow the Super Better link on the front page at onthemedia.org. Jane, thanks to you too.
Sure, my pleasure.
Jane McGonigal is the designer of Super Better and the author of Reality is Broken: Why Games Can Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World.
Next week, Zynga, the company behind popular Facebook games like Farmville and Cityville, will have its initial public offering. Industry analysts have valued the company at $15 to $20 billion. More than 200 million people play Zynga games each month, but despite its success, the company inspires mostly grumbling from the video gamerati. Zynga's critics say its games are designed to addict gamers and suck money out of their pockets. One such critic, game designer Ian Bogost, figured the best way to criticize these games would be to build a vicious parody of them. But despite his worst intentions, that's not how it played out. OTM producer PJ Vogt reports.
Last summer, Cindy Barrett got hooked on this Facebook game. The way the game works, you get a point every time you click. Cindy was battling her brother, Eric, who was routinely beating her.
At that point, I maybe had 10 clicks a week. My brother would always have 12 clicks, and it would make me frustrated. So I befriended the top clickers. They taught me how to get more clicks. Literally within a day, I had something like 200 clicks. And I was like, hey, Eric, is there any way you can compete with me? Because I think at that point he had 6. And it just went downhill from there.
The game is called Cow Clicker. It's the work of a video game designer named Ian Bogost. Bogost creations are usually more like art than entertainment. People don't typically get hooked on them. Take his most recent work, a game poem called A Slow Year. The point of the game is to experience the seasons.
The winter game, sun is rising, it's dawn, and you've got a cup of coffee, which is slowly getting cold, and you want to kind of time your enjoyment of the cup of coffee with the amount of time that it's going to take the sun to rise. It's a first-person drinking game for the Atari.
Bogost hates popular social networking video games. Games like Farmville that clog your Facebook newsfeed with notifications about how your aunt just harvested her virtual crops or your dad put out a hit on a mob boss. He decided the best way to criticize those games would be to make the dumbest one he could imagine. That was Cow Clicker, the game Cindy found. The reductio ad absurdum of Facebook games.
You know, a game in which all you do is click on a cow and that's it. Maybe you pay for the privilege to click on a cow.
You click your cow, it moves. Wait 6 hours and you can click it again. Or you can get virtual money, either through clicks or by spending real cash that you spend to reset the timer and immediately click again.
People took notice. The media took notice.
Leah Alexander is a game journalist who's also friends with Boghost. She wrote about CalClicker for the website Kotaku.
He was in every gaming magazine and some non-gaming magazines regarding CalClicker. It was much more popular than I think he had ever predicted it would be.
Game journalists liked CalClicker because they got the joke. And as more players poured in, Boghost was surprised to find himself feeling pretty proud.
Gleeful. I mean, when people play your game, you can't help but feel pleasure. That's what you want. And I did feel that way for some time, especially when, you know, there was a relatively even distribution of different kinds of reactions.
The resulting buzz brought in more players, but most of them weren't in on the joke.
Somewhere along the line, his larger user base began to be people who either they understood it was a joke and they still enjoyed it, or they just didn't get it, or they just didn't care. Like, people really loved their cows.
50,000 people. For many of them, CalClicker was just another mindless, addictive Facebook game, indistinguishable from the mindless, addictive games it was meant to parody.
The ironist players dropped off. What I was left with were real players who were making demands, you know, who wanted things that I wasn't giving them in the game. They wanted different cows. They, you know, they wanted, like, Cthulhu.
Wait, Cthulhu?
Yeah, they wanted a Lovecraftian Cthulhu cow, Cthulhu.
That's the bovine equivalent of a tentacled creature named Cthulhu, created by H.P. Lovecraft and beloved by geeks. Still psyched that people were into his game, Boghost gave them what they wanted.
You know, it was a pirate cow, a ninja cow, and a cow that cost over $100. When you bought that cow, we sent a real cow to the third world, you know. I was very eager to put more material into the game to see how people would react.
But eventually, he got uneasy.
After a while, I realized they're doing exactly what concerned me about these games. They were, you know, becoming compulsively attached to it. There was one point when I realized that I was now attached to it in a compulsive way. I was worrying about what the cow clickers thought while I was away from the game. And that was the moment at which I both felt kind of empathy with the players, and also I began to feel very disturbed by the product.
He decided to sabotage the game, to tweak it, to make it more maddening, more dumb.
At one point, he took the default cow, switched it to face the other direction, and charged $20 for it. And people bought it.
Boghost couldn't diminish people's love for CalClicker. The game generated its own fan culture.
CalClicker poetry, silkscreen printed t-shirts. There was this woman who did these sort of CalClicker portraits of all her CalClicker friends.
Boghost decided that if he couldn't ruin CalClicker, he'd kill it. He got in touch with friends across the world, and he had them hide clues in the real world for CalClicker diehards to find. Once assembled, the clues spelled out a chilling prophecy.
Cowpocalypse. And then there was this timer that started running, and if the timer ended, then, you know, the game would shut down. At least that was the implication. I never really said what would happen.
In a final twist of perversity, Boghost designed his game-ending countdown clock to speed up whenever anyone played the game, and to reset if people paid money.
I wanted the players to feel like they were accelerating their own demise by playing and then be tempted to maybe purchase their way out of it. And several people, like, extended the clock at the very last minute a few times.
When you create something, you don't get to decide how it'll be received. Ian Boghost's game wasn't designed to be enjoyable, but it turned out to be possibly the most resonant game he's ever made. His take on what that might mean is actually pretty optimistic.
It shows us how weird and complicated simple things really are, and shows me not that, like, I'm some sort of brilliant designer who made this thing that was bigger than I thought it was, but how resilient and creative people are. I did this thing that was CalClicker, and in spite of it, they rose above and made it something more than it really was.
That's one way to look at it. Here's another. You remember that countdown clock?
When the clock finally counted down to zero, there was a cow rapture.
Here's how the cowpocalypse actually transpired.
All of the cows were whisked away, and all that was left were the little shadows where they had been standing. But the game continued to run, and in fact, the game continues to run to this day. And there are still people clicking on the spot where a cow used to be.
Boghost still gets messages from confused cow clickers. A typical complaint, which Lee Alexander, the video game journalist, published, read that after the rapture, CalClicker was, quote, not a very fun game any longer. Boghost answered, it wasn't very fun before. For Boghost, CalClicker was never about fun. It was a joke. But as it turned out, The joke was on him. For On the Media, I'm PJ Vogt.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Dylan Keefe, Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Doug Anderson and Gianna Palmer, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and more engineering help from Dylan.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Moo.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.